Group's summer school meeting at the Senecal Greyshot, Thursday morning, 9th April 1981. Every single member of the human species is composed of two aspects. One is the fact that he is derived physically, psychophysically, from a primordial animal ancestor. And the other is that he contains within himself the potentiality of the supreme development which is possible for him in mind and consciousness. A development which we may legitimately call a divine development. Now these two aspects function at their own level in two different ways. The way of the animal, which is our psychophysical being, purely as such, belongs to the context of the finite, the temporal, and the mortal. It functions in the realm of death. Death is lord of this perishable part of us. The other, our divine potentiality, belongs to the context of the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal. Now these two contexts are completely interrelated one with another. Those of you who have been present at our meetings during the last 4 or 5 months will recall that we considered this matter rather carefully in terms of trying to understand the nature of a point which has a purely conceptual existence only. It has no length, breadth, nor depth. So, in that sense, it is infinite, the point in itself. Because if it has no length, breadth, or depth, it has no manifested material existence. It is immeasurable. And as such belongs to a transcendent realm. Now, we can conceive of a point. We can also conceive of a succession of points, side by side. But we won't get a line that way, because there will always be a gap between any two points. But if a point moves, and remember, life is movement. If a point moves, it acts integratively and produces a line. A line has one dimension only, length. But this length is measurable, and as such, it belongs to the realm of the finite and the mortal. The infinite point has produced a finite manifestation by a particular act, namely movement. A line, like a point, is invisible and intangible. It is only conceivable. Now, if a line similarly moves at right angles to itself, it will produce a surface. You cannot produce a surface by having an infinite number of lines side by side. The line has to move, it has to come to life, start into activity. And it produces a surface, which again by itself, although two-dimensional, is invisible and intangible. But it is measurable and belongs to the realm of the finite. again. Now, if the surface moves at right angles to itself and produces a solid object, then you have a three-dimensional object which is both visible and tangible. So now you see how the infinite number of lines produces a finite surface, the infinite number of surfaces produce a solid object. The infinite, eternal, and the immortal, and the context of the finite, the temporal, and the mortal are completely interrelated, one with another, and they are completely interactive. This is a point of the utmost importance when we try to understand the depths of scriptural teachings. Because scriptural teachings are the expressions of a consciousness at a transcendent level, making affirmations about the nature of transcendence itself. Affirmations which can be interpreted by the finite brain in innumerable ways. Now, if we bear this in mind, we will see that in our own being, the transcendent and the mortal are in complete interaction. We are a unity as such. Now, if we understand that fairly clearly, we will begin to see what is the purpose of our existence as human beings on the face of the globe. There is this evolutionary process which brought forth the psychophysical organism termed man. There is also this developmental process going on right from the beginning by which man, the psychophysical being, the person, the mortal, perishable person, is growing in such a manner that through his complete purification, the light of transcendence can shine through him, and he as an individual can become quite conscious of the transcendent reality as such, the one total reality. We find this taught in the different scriptures of the world. For instance, in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, we have the teaching that Brahman or Atma, realizing that he himself, or it itself, I should say, was composed of a positive and negative aspect, a male and a female aspect, joined together in one as such. And it caused this feminine side to fall apart from the masculine side, the negative to fall apart from the positive side. Now, which is the negative side which really gives all the energy for activity and for growth and development as such. Just as in an atom, it's the negative electrons which are responsible for the properties and the activity of any particular chemical element as such. This is a very important point. And so these two fall apart. Now, having fallen apart, I'm referring now to Brahman or Atma, having fallen apart as such, they interact, and by their interact, they produce human beings with intelligence. This intelligence is very, very important. It's the linking factor between the mortal and the immortal, between the temporal and the eternal. You'll find it in the very first chapter, section 4 of the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. It's not easy to penetrate into this, but persevere, and perhaps helped by the chapter on the Upanishads in the heart of religion, you may get at it. Consider again the way in which it is presented in Genesis. The first chapter, verse 25, and Elohim said, that is how it is translated, let us make man in our own image. And male, female created he them. That is to say, each individual being is male and female. It doesn't refer to that part of the human race which it consists of males and the other part which consists of females. But in each and every one of us, there is the male and the female element intermixed. The male body having, as you know, the female anima, and the female body having the male animus. Just as in the Upanishad, the void, mind space, akasha, is the invisible part, which falls apart and represents the female energy as such. I prefer the suggestion made in the Jerusalem edition of the Bible to use the term, and Elohim said, let us make man in our own likeness. I would prefer the whole thing to be presented this way, and Elohim minded, because mind at its transcendent level is the creative energy which brings the entire cosmos into being. That is pure mind as such. And Elohim minded, let us create, it is the creative power, mind, let us create man in our own living likeness. And male, female made he them. Now if you take this translation, you will see that the very term Yahweh, Yod, He, and Vav, He, the term itself, which is translated as the Lord, Elohim is God, the creative energy per se, and Yahweh is this creative energy immanent in us, which is the moving and inspiring energy which pushes us towards fulfillment in terms of realization by our own selves of what we actually are and what is our destiny. So Yahweh consists of two parts, a male and a female, and it also represents the body at the level of the psychophysical organism. It represents body and psyche in continuous interaction with each other, fecundating each other. Note that word, fecundating each other. This is very, very important, because we'll see, therefore, that nothing is dispensable. Neither the body nor the psyche in our present state is dispensable. They are both indispensable elements of a whole living organism, which in its fruition and fulfillment will be the instrument, the apparatus, if you like, through which the total transcendent power will manifest itself freely as man, and what the word man really means, and particularly what the word human really means. And now if you look at the Zarathustrian teaching, Zarathustra in the Gathas starts off his very first sermon, which is on the origin of evil, saying, now I will declare to earnest listeners teaching concerning the twin mind, the good mind and the evil mind. I will declare concerning the praise and adoration due to Ahura. Ahura means Lord. It corresponds to the Jewish Elohim, and Mazda, the good mind, is the other part of the name of the Supreme Being, Ahura Mazda. Ahura Mazda is can be translated simply as God. But remember, it has two aspects. And lastly, of the sacred word of Asha, which means purity or righteousness, and it also stands for the divine law. The divine law being that power which brings all things to fruition and is continuously inherent in every single thing and person and creature throughout the universe. That is Asha. And then, see that the twin mind places fairly and squarely upon our own shoulders our responsibility to make the right choice. Zarathustrianism was the first great religion in the world to emphasize the freedom of choice of individual men and women. Absolute freedom of choice. And then, later on in the same gatha, he goes on, since, O Mazda, Mazda is wisdom, from the beginning thou didst fashion for us physical bodies, discerning souls, and directive intelligences through thy own mind. Since thou didst infuse life breath into mortal bones, since thou didst grant us capacities to act and true doctrines to guide so that one could choose beliefs at will. One may choose the wrong beliefs or the right beliefs and so forth, you see. Now, the importance of this is just here, that the declaration is made that everything, that which belongs to the sphere of the mortal, the realm of death, as well as that which belongs to the sphere of the immortal, was created by that primordial, undifferentiated, creative energy, because of which the entire universe comes into being. We can see then what our responsibility as human beings is. Because if we see that, then we can begin to live humanly, in the true sense of the word. Now, these two aspects within us are not contrary aspects. The context of the finite and the mortal, and the context of the infinite and the immortal. Note how the Buddha said, for instance, there is, O monks, an unborn, unbecome, unmade, and he goes on to say, if there were not, then there would be no release from bondage to the born, the become, and the made. What is this, release from bondage? It is that we ourselves will grow in mind and consciousness in such a manner that we shall realize continuously, and we shall abide in that state continuously, realize the immortal state, the deathless state. His first words to the five, when he gave his first sermon, he starts off by the tremendous affirmation, hearken bhikkhus, the deathless has been found. And he goes on to expound that, and how one may realize that. I dare say the actual sermon lasted all through the night. I wouldn't be surprised if that were the actual fact. Here was something which was truly world-shaking. for those people in India. And he makes that affirmation. The deathless has to be realized by us, in other words. And the realizing of the deathless means the realizing of the eternal and the immortal. And it means also that we have quite transcended the conflict of the pairs of opposites. Pleasure, pain, particularly. Joy, sorrow. Good, evil. Good and evil as we define, perceive and define good and evil by our own limited perceptions which we have at present. This is a particularly important point because there is no such thing as a fixed morality which has been presented through the activity of our brains. There is an immutable morality, an immutable ethic, if you like, in terms of the eternal only. It is the ethic which is born of the perception of the fact that throughout anything and everything there is this this power working for the fruition of man in that manner which will make him the instrument of transcendence itself. So there is the sort of ultimate source of all our moral imperatives and so forth. Therefore, it becomes essential for us to understand the purpose of our existence, which we have tried to consider just now, and bring it the ways and means by which we can enable that purpose to unfold itself through our everyday life. Take again the presentation in the yoga teachings. Now, all of you who are interested in yoga should bear this very carefully in mind. We have the presentation of the different chakras, the seven chakras, as we call them. The first three deal with us as finite mortal beings. Mooladhara, the source of primordial energy, remember. Swadhisthana, which represents particularly our activities in the world as sexual beings. It represents, and of course, in marital congress, that finds its highest expression. That is to say, its most intense expression rather than highest as such. It becomes a highest and a supreme expression only when marital congress is performed as a ritual, as a sacrifice. This is very little known. It's practically unknown in the world. In the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, for instance, at the very end of that Upanishad, there is a section which deals with this sort of thing and tells you how to make the sexual act a sacrificial ritual act and therefore a creative act if you wish to produce children who will be true Brahmins. And a Brahmin, in its deepest meaning, you'll find this in the Vajrasuchi Upanishad, a little known Upanishad. A true Brahman is one who has realized Brahman, realized the ultimate reality. That is to say, completely fulfilled the purpose of his existence. That is why sexual congress is of such tremendous importance and sanctity. And it's that sanctity and importance, both of them have been more or less completely forgotten by the whole of the human race. So, that is Swadhisthana then. It deals with that aspect. And then third, the Manipura, just at the navel, deals with the digestion of all our worldly experience, our worldly knowledge, which enables us to earn our own living and perform our duties in the right way in our worldly situation. That means to say that if you are by nature a carpenter, your business is to be the perfect carpenter. If by nature you are a musician, all right, be the perfect musician. I don't suppose pop singing was known in those days at all. And a good thing too, perhaps. So, according to what you are, according to the gifts which nature has given you, that digestion has to take place through your study, through your activity, and through all your expression in your daily life. Now, those three chakras represent, therefore, the finite, the temporal, and the mortal side of you. Then comes Anahata at the heart center, which represents the first entry into the purely human state, the state wherein you actually begin to realize, not merely to think or believe in, the unity of the human race as such. Not only the unity of the human race, but a unity and an indivisibility in relationship to the entire universe. This is of fundamental importance. The first intense consciousness of these things begins at Anahata. And then the other three centers, Vishuddhi at the throat center, as the throat center, Ajna there between the eyebrows, and the Sahasrara, the thousand petal lotus at the top of the head, represent the transcendent side, which deal with the meditative state as such. True meditation takes place only as and when these three centers have come into activity. That is to say these three centers have become active is a symbolic way of saying that in mind and consciousness and in your whole being, you are able to live in this completely unified condition. Now, therefore, this is the transcendent aspect, that is the mortal and finite aspect, and they are linked at the heart center. The heart center is the link for the individual with all his fellow human beings all over. Now you'll see how what I said at the beginning holds good. The spine is a single spine right the way through, isn't it? From the base to the top of the head. Right up to the top of the spine. So that the transcendent and the mortal are in complete interrelationship, in complete activity, in relationship to each other as such. The two contexts, therefore, actually interfuse and become one total context as and when the yogi reaches the fullness of perfection as a yogi. I don't know how well you know your Patanjali Sutras, for instance. You will find in the third chapter the positive assertion made that all the preliminary stages of yoga, of yama, niyama, asana, and pranayama, they are all preparations to enable you to enter through pratyahara. That is the fifth one, through pratyahara, to link up with dhyana, dharana, and samadhi. And dhyana, dharana, and samadhi are positively declared by Patanjali in the Yoga Sutras as the real yoga. All the rest is just preliminary kindergarten work. It's just a preparation. Now do remember that, those of you who are interested in yoga and practice yoga and so forth, do not regard it as a physical culture system or as a way or a method of attaining psychic powers and so forth. You will have all the psychic powers you'd like to play with if you go the straight path right through. They will all come naturally. Just as when the physical body, after birth, grows up, all the ordinary physical powers, assuming that no accident takes place or something like that, all the ordinary physical abilities and powers will belong to the body which has been born in course of time, as the body grows up to maturity and fullness. But here you have a remarkable presentation of involving an understanding of the purpose of our existence, of the way by which that purpose can be fulfilled, by which your own individual development and growth can take place in the right way, in the true way. It's not easy. It's extremely difficult. But then, is there anything truly worthwhile in the world which is easy and not difficult? Everything needs very hard work. One is arriving at perfection. You find this perfection mentioned particularly in the Zarathustrian scriptures in a very remarkable way. Zarathustra declares categorically that whoso lives by Asha, the divine law of righteous, pure living, the perfect morality, the perfect ethic, whoever lives by that, in that way, to him Ahura Mazda will grant Haurvatat, which is holiness, perfection, and Ameritat, which is immortality, and also invest in him his own divine creative power, Kshatravairya, as it is called, you see, and enable him to live the pure and simple life, which means the holy life. And this, of course, immediately ties up with the teachings in Buddhism and in Hinduism about treading the Brahmacharya, treading the path. What is the meaning of treading the Brahmacharya? Charya means a walking, Charya. Charana is a walk. A walking in and to Brahma. That is its full meaning, the Brahmacharya. Walking in and to Brahma. And it is peculiarly in line with the teachings of the great Christian mystics. A walking in and to God. It's very strange how centuries afterwards, this presentation came in Christian mysticism very strongly. And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe it comes in Sufi mysticism also. A walking in and to God as such. God is a convenient word. You can use any word you like instead. Make any sound to represent that which is the unknown and remains the unknowable by the brain, but which can be realized through mind and consciousness by any and every individual. So the Brahmacharya means that, a walking in and to God. But look at its implication. How do you walk in God? When, for instance, the fetus is growing and I am just becoming something like a human being inside my mother's womb. Am I walking inside my mother? Perhaps I am in a strange, unknown way. But it's something like that. But you see the implication. The transcendent is omnipresent. We live and move and have our being in that one total reality, in that transcendent reality, the supreme reality, the reality which in its primordial essential nature is and remains the unknown and the unknowable by the brain. But how is our ordinary life moved? Our ordinary life is moved by the power which is represented in the three lower chakras, the Mooladhara, the Swadhisthana, and the Manipura. Food, sex, and worldly activity, making a living, getting rich, having status symbols, fulfilling ambitions, and all the rest of that nonsense is the way that we do live. Let us have no illusions about it. We think we are interested in religion. We believe, quite sincerely believe, but a sincere belief need not be truth. We believe quite sincerely that we wish to do the right thing, to serve God, to serve our fellow man, and all the rest of it. Please, please, do think carefully, and think not argumentatively, but penetratively. So try and see the fact as it is, the extraordinarily subtle way in which this separative self-consciousness of ours wants to hold us down to our own self as the one and only worthwhile thing in the world. This is what we hold truly worthy. It is not wrong to hold this as truly worthy, because this is the indispensable instrument by means of which that supreme can be realized. Realized not by you or me as a separate person, but the realization means that transcendence realizes itself through the separate person, who is utterly free of the plague, the curse of his self-conscious, separative outlook upon himself. I am I and not you. But when that disappears, and the I am I has everything else has also become the I am I, or put it the other way, the I am I is completely interrelated to the totality, then the right thing has happened, and life has, human life has been fulfilled as such. Now, these very fundamental things, it is important to understand these very fundamental things. Don't believe a word of what I say. Don't reject a single word of what I say out of hand. Through the mouths of babes and sucklings cometh forth wisdom. And I am reaching very rapidly the happy state, the second babyhood. And in that state, perhaps something worthwhile may emerge out of this out of this instrument. Loud laughter. Why? You see? So don't reject out of hand what I say. There is profound reality involved in all these things. A truth which, if we can begin to respond to it, thrill to it, will completely transform our lives, whatever our age may be. It makes no difference whatsoever. After all, I'm speaking out of 65 to 70, in fact, 70 years of experience and interest, absorbing interest in all this. Immortality was the one thing that absolutely enthralled me right from the age of 5 onwards. What is immortality? Is it the childish belief that I, the separate individual, will continue to be perpetually through all time? That absurd impossibility is the belief that all people have, and all people, that is to say those who feel like it, strive for it. Now that is hopeless altogether. If one can get rid of that striving for the I, either in worldly terms or otherworldly terms, it matters not which, if one can cease to do that, then one can begin to live as a human being in the right manner. So now I think I have presented or tried to present all the important points in connection with our theme on living humanly. And I'll continue the theme on Saturday. I'll continue with that theme on Saturday morning again. In the meanwhile, please, your questions, which we may all try to answer. Thank you.